I'm an alcoholic.
Amen.
My sobriety date's October 22nd, 2001. A lot of people in this room, man, it's amazing. I'll start off with, in 2002, this meeting used to be in the church right before you go over to Davis Island, and there was like 10 of us, and I imagine before that it was even smaller. So it's really neat and exciting to see this many people grow in the matter of like 9 years. And I feel it here, I really do. The camaraderie, the people looking out for each other, the events, it's just amazing the warmth that you feel at this meeting. I was born in New Jersey, and my mom's Jewish, my dad's Jewish, and the reason I say that is because they got a divorce when I was like 3, and my mom got remarried to a guy that is Christian, and we moved down to Central Florida. So it was really weird because we moved to this little country town where there's no Jews. So there was like 10. So we celebrated Christmas. We celebrated Hanukkah. You know, my mom is like, she just loves, you know, celebrations. You know, my dad's like this real introverted. He's not anymore, but he was real introverted, you know, just kind of like Southern boy. And the reason I say that is because by the time I was maybe 7 or 8 and I would hang out with certain people, if they found out you were Jewish, you know, their friend might be like, you know, my mom told me you're going to hell. And I'd be like, what do you mean? You know, so I'd go home. So I'd go home to my mom and be like, Mom, I'm going to hell. And she's like, what do you mean? And I'm like, well, Bart's mom told him that, you know, I'm going to hell because I'm Jewish. And, you know, I thought we're both. And, you know, she's like, oh, don't worry about that. And so as I grew up, you know, my parents, like spiritually wise, they were like, if you're a good person, you'll know the basis of all religions. So anyway, to get back to my drinking and drugging story. My brother's 2.5 years older than me. And when he was about 13, he got busted for drinking, and I was part of it, but they didn't think little Daniel, who was 10, had been drinking. So I'm watching these guys get in trouble for sneaking into the liquor cabinet. You know, they were, my dad came home, and my brother's friend was upside down in the driveway on his bike. So, you know, I'm just watching these guys get in trouble. And I think I really thought, I was thinking about it today, because it came to me about that incident. And at around 10, I thought, man, I can get away with this drinking. So when I was 13, I was in 7th grade, and I went to the bus stop, and about 3 or 4 of us were there, and my buddy's like, hey, you want to skip school? This guy's house that I dog sit for has a keg. I had no clue really what was going on. He's like, it's got a lot of beer in it. And my parents were weekend warriors. They're both professionals, but you know, from Friday night till Sunday, it was like hang out with the friends, drink, have fun, come Monday, put on your business face, you know, don't drink, excuse me, and, you know, do it all over. And it seemed like they were, you know, having a great time, and they, you know, I think they were. They're just not alcoholics. So, you know, we skip school, and we go break into this guy's place, and we start getting drunk off this keg. We got milk jugs, and we're just drinking. And two things happened. One, my mom taught at a school by there, and the secretary there saw some of us walking by. And later on that day, one of the guys passed out in the street, and I guess we left him there. And he got, you know, found. So the secretary goes to my mom and is like, hey, do you think Daniel's with these guys? You know, they used to hang out when they were in grade school. And my mom, you know, no, Daniel wouldn't skip school. You know, Daniel's good. You know, there's no way. So they find out one of my other friends had skipped school. And so my mom's like, I better call. So they call. I'm not in school. So my mom and this other lady, Javier's mom, go searching for us. You know, they're knocking on doors. And I mean, it was just, you know, a bad scene. And they finally find us at this one guy's house. The door's unlocked. And here comes my mom, you know, Jewish Italian lady, and Javier's mom, full-blown Spanish. Where are y'all? What's going on? You know, everyone just runs, hiding. Javier's mom has the shoe off, beating Javi, speaking in Spanish. And, you know, the other two guys, their parents were more lenient, so you know, their parents were like, whatever, you know. So our parents take us down to the hospital. And this is just to show you how much my family minimized alcohol. They did not really care about the drinking. Their big thing was, you know, did you take drugs? And we're like, no. They're like, you must have taken something. Y'all are not all there. And, you know, we went down there, took the drug test, turned out fine. You know, so I got reprimanded. And that was right around the time my life had changed. I was playing baseball, and I wasn't as good as my brother. He was a natural. My sister was a ballerina. She was really good. She started at 4 years old. You know, she wanted to go professional. And, you know, I was just like, what am I good at, you know? And it plays out later on in my life, so I was like, I'll just start working. And I got an after-school job with my parents' friend, and I would basically work during the week and then hang out with my buddies and drink on the weekends, make forts, go hunting, go fishing. I mean, that was pretty much my MO from 13 to 15. So just drank a lot. And at 15, I had some money saved. And the reason I mention this isn't to really boast, but I had this fear that, like, no one was going to take care of me. You know, like, one day my parents are going to be gone, my grandparents are going to be gone, and I need a place to go, you know. I'm going to be left all alone. So I go to my grandpa, who owns some property, and I'm like, hey, Papa, how do you, you know, buy some property? And he's like, what are you talking about? I said, you know, I got a couple $1,000s saved up. I'd like to buy some property. He's like, for what? And I'm just like, you know, just a place to go to in case the shit hits the fan, and, you know. I didn't say shit, but you know what I mean. So he's like, well, you know, every once in a while they'll have these auctions, and you go to them, and you can get a good deal. So I was like, well, tell me when one happens. So, like, the following year comes up, and we went to one, and that was, like, my achievement, you know, because my brother, here he is, you know, awesome baseball player, football player, you know, soccer, you know, he played every sport, you know, so he had his, you know, place in our family. You know, my sister, you know, waking up at 4 a.m, going to this whatever type of school to be a professional dancer and doing her academia. So I wanted my name on the board, you know. I felt like I was like the lone duck, like I was nothing unless I had something up there. So after I got that property, it was like, you know, my parents, I felt like, could be like, okay, I get some recognition. And so after that, I was just like, okay, I'm going to, you know, keep drinking and go to University of Florida, be a general contractor, build houses, hunt and fish. You know, that was what I wanted to do. And got a long ways to go. So, and I also want to say thanks to the lady that spoke before me, because the honesty that came out of her was just unbelievable. And I can ditto everything she said on the steps. She couldn't, no, I mean, couldn't have said it any more eloquent. At 16, we used to drink a lot on the weekends, and I'll tell you a little drunk story. So we would get chased by the cops because we'd like hang out in the orange groves, or we'd hang out in the Publix parking lot, and, you know, they would just move us around. And, you know, it wasn't as strict as it is today. So their main thing was, you know, littering and making a scene. So one time we're going to go to this one guy's house, and I was about the only guy that knew how to get there. So I was like, follow me. And there was about 20 cars. So we go down this road, Register Road, and I'm like, man, where'd everybody go? You know, they must have got stuck at a stoplight. So I slow up at this T-bone, and the car pulls up behind me. So I think everybody's caught up. So I kind of, you know, I got to peel out a little and go to do another corner. And there's the sirens, you know. And I'm like, oh, my God, I'm done. I got a tall boy open, and I got one more in the car. And or in the truck, and I'm freaking out. I'm shaking more than I am now. And you know, I mean, I was unbelievable. It was just one of the scariest moments, because I was like, I'm gonna lose my license, and that was everything to me at that time. 16, got my vehicle, and he's, you know, like, step out of the car, He's like, "You've been drinking?" And I just said, "Yes, sir." You know, I mean, there's beer all over my car because the tall boy spilled. And so he starts writing me up. You know, I can't do anything. And, you know, I'm about to get a DUI or a DWI. And he just kept looking at my picture, and people are driving back and forth on their CBs, you know, and, "What's up?" You know, and I'm sitting there getting arrested. And he's like, "You look familiar." And my name hadn't changed yet, but everybody knew me by Davidson, and my biological name was on my license. And he's like, "Man, you just look familiar." And I'm like, "Man, you do too." And he's like, "Are you Lyndon's grandson?" I'm like, "Yeah." And he's like, I'm like, "Oh my God, I met you one time. We were hunting together." And he's just like, "Oh man, you know what type of trouble, you know?" He said, boom, he tore up the thing, saved me from a DUI. And I look back on that because, you know, that would have been definitely one of my turning points. If I would have got a DUI, my parents would have just, it would have been crazy around my household. So, you know, I kind of got saved there. But looking back on consequences, you know, that was a huge consequence, you know. Then after that, that's 16, made good grades, started getting into weed a little, and went off to college. And that was a highlight of my life, you know. University of Florida, I love the Gators. My brother was going to school there. He was finishing up. I grew up going up there on the weekends sometime. And, you know, things happen up there. You know, I got into other things. And I sold myself, like, right when I got up there, because my parents are kind of, like, independent. They're not really into fraternities or anything. And my roommate was Russian. Not Russian from Russia, but Russian, like, the fraternity. And so, you know, he's like, "Hey, why don't you come with us?" And, you know, I'm a tight ass. And I'm like, "Man, I don't want to go to lunch to save some money." And he's like, "It's free." And I'm like, "I'll go." So we go to this thing called Rush, you know, and all these guys are coming up to you, talking to you, you know, "What do you do?" You know, just all this stuff, where you're from, you know. And I kind of caught on to what was going on, you know, like, "What's going on here?" And these people are talking, and this guy comes up to me, and he's like, "Did you get a bid?" And I'm like, "What's that?" You know, he's like, "Well, that's when they give you an offer if you want to get in their fraternity." And I got kind of competitive. I'm like, man, I started kind of selling my game and stuff. I'm like, "Man, I'm going to get into this thing." And, well, long story short, first of all, I had long hair at the time. And it was kind of a conservative fraternity. And I had it up in my hat. So I was like, man, they have no clue. They're talking to, like, kind of like a long-haired, you know, crazy guy from the sticks. And, you know, I ended up getting a bid, and I felt like the coolest person. You know, I was like, man, these guys, you know, it's, I got it, man. And when I let my hair down after I got the bid, they were like, they had no clue. They were like, "Bro, you're the first kid to ever pull off something like that," you know, because just because of hair, they may not have even accepted me. So I got into that, and then I really didn't like it. There was some regular partying, this and that, and the rave scene was going pretty crazy. It was 1993. And in Orlando and Tampa and Gainesville and probably all over the country, you know, the rave scene was pretty big. And sorry if I talk about drugs a little, it's a little bit of my story. So, and it's good. In the big book, they do talk a little bit about morphine and sedatives. So I guess it is somewhat acceptable. I got really big into ecstasy, you know. I thought I had found the cure to life. And, I was like, man, this is awesome. And I started dealing to keep up with my habit. The next semester, I tried to quit everything cold turkey. And after a big bender, and I ended up basically not being able to sleep for a long time, had delusions, had a I forgot what type of stroke, where this side of my right eye started drooping, like face went numb. It was pretty scary. I was a lifeguard the summer before, and I wasn't even able to use like my legs completely for at least a good year, where I felt like, you know, that everything was working in conjunction with each other. So that was probably my first big consequence. That was in 1994. So there I am, 19, and my parents thought I was, you know, doing all right at college, and this happened. So come home, and my parents want me to see a therapist and or something. I don't remember. I was so delusional. They bring me over here to Tampa to talk to someone, and I talk to him. And I go, have you tried this? Have you tried that? You know, all these different drugs. And he's like, no. I got out of that meeting. I'm like, Mom, Dad, there's no way this guy can help me. You know, he's never done any of this stuff. There's just no way. So I thought my big problem was I didn't work the first year of college. My parents were paying for it. And going back to being a workaholic as a kid, I was like, that's my problem. I wasn't working. I wasn't staying focused. I need to go back to school. So I got a job. And, you know, all that started going good. And then I got back into dealing, and then I got back into using. And the following year, same thing happened, hit a bottom, had to withdraw. And then my dad came up to school, and it was probably one of the most devastating moments in my life up till then. He wanted to have a talk with me, and my brother had moved out of my place because he said, you know, if you're going to keep dealing, I'm moving out. So I was like, screw you, you know, because we were using together. And he moved out, and my dad came up there and, you know, said he didn't want a drug dealer in his family. And I had no clue, and it just hurt. It just hurt so bad, to, you know, because I really respect my dad and look up to him. And for him to say those things, I know it just had to be tough. So I tried to straighten up my act. There was no use of that. See, that's college there. So then I go, how about this, Mom and Dad? How about I move home? They had like this little guest house, and I had a girlfriend at the time. I was like, how about you let me and Tammy move in that house, and I'll get my life together. And my dad about fell over, because my sister's still growing up, and he's kind of conservative, and, you know, doing that whole thing was just kind of weird. But he loves me, so he let me do it. And I got my act together. I started working. I was scared of doing drugs and alcohol. I would just, you know, dabble a little. And went back to college, had two of my best years ever at University of Florida, you know, took really hard classes, changed majors from building instruction to agriculture. It was my dream. I was going to start, you know, doing large-scale farming. And I know, and everybody's like, yeah, what were you growing? And and I was growing a little of that, too. And so by my senior year, I got into organic farming. And my whole big thing was wake up, go to school, excuse me, study, get all your work done, and then party. And that's what I did. So what happened was, is my senior year, I decided I didn't tell anybody, and I thought about moving out to Colorado because I'd already traveled around the country a little. And me and my brother were going to start this business out there. And I don't know why I didn't talk to anybody. I think I was scared because most of my friends were graduating, because I was a year behind because I withdrew two different quarters. So I was a year, total year behind. And in the back of my mind, I'm like, man, what am I going to do next year? You know, all my friends are gone. They're all freaking out about getting jobs. And I sold myself this theory that, you know, I can always come back to school, but they're all going out to Colorado. I can start a business out there. Why don't I just go and I'll just finish it later? So that was 1998. And I didn't tell my parents that. And I just drove out there my senior year, started this business with my brother. And I ended up staying. And then I ended up getting into it with my brother a little. And I was like, you know, we both made a little bit of money. And I just got in my van, I sold my truck, and headed out west, and ended up in like California, Oregon, Washington, British Columbia, and obviously I was getting into my hippie days, and I just wanted to be a big time pot grower. And you know, people were making serious money, and I enjoyed the lifestyle. I really thought, you know, my family wasn't necessarily my family. I had other family out here, and you know, it lasted for a little while. And this girl and I were going through a breakup, and man, I got trashed, and I drove into the city. And my car, or my van, the clutch went out. It was like one of those VW buses. And I just freaked out, you know, and I was so pissed. I just left it at the stoplight, got out walking, and I had my dog with me. And, like, I got about two blocks, and I'm like, damn, you better go back and get your vehicle. So I start walking back, and by the time I got to my vehicle, there's cops, you know, writing it up. So I'm like, shit, I got stuff in there. I'd rather go get it out of impound. So I start hanging out with people on the streets. And then I'm like, okay, I could go home to my girl, but we're getting into it. So I'm just going to hang out here. Well, next thing you know, I start, you know, living on the streets. I'm like, screw going home. I mean, it was just really bizarre. So, living on the streets became not that much fun. It was in the winter, you know, winter of Oregon. You know, it's just, it's cold, it's wet, and ended up getting thrown in a detox by a cop. And then I threatened a guy in there because I was like, man, he seemed kind of sketchy. And I got a problem with that. So then they threw me in isolation and then threw me in the mental hospital. And that was scary. I'd never been in detox. I'd never been in a mental hospital. And I just couldn't believe it. So when I came to in the mental hospital, because they drugged you up on a bunch of stuff, I probably Thorazine, I was doing the shuffle, whatever they talk about. I was doing it. I was drooling. I was like, you know, what's going on? So this lady in there was talking about some music concert happening, and that kind of snapped me too, because I go see, you know, concerts. So I'm like, shit, I got to get out of here, you know? So I start playing the game, like, yes, sir, no, sir, this, that. And then I'm like, oh, my gosh, my dog, you know, they took my dog. I got to get my dog out of the pound. And so luckily they let me out. And I have enough time before she got euthanized. I got her 2 days before she was supposed to be euthanized. And so I got my dog out, called my girl, got back to the house. We got rid of everything there. And I literally prayed to God. I was like, God, bring someone into my life that can save me, you know, that can, like, help me out. I'm getting broke. You know, just bring someone into my life. And this guy named Dane, who works with a larger band, a touring band, just out of the blue, I'd known him like a year ago, he calls me. And he's like, what's up, man? I'm like, well, it's not that good. You know, going through a breakup, getting broke. And he's like, why don't you come down here and live with me? And he lived in North California at Mount Shasta, which is like an awesome place. And so I'm like, hey, man. Here's the story. I don't have much. You know, he's like, don't worry, man. I got you covered. You know, anything you need, I take care of you. My son's moving up here. I'd love for y'all to hang out. You can tour around with us with the band, you know. And, I mean, he had such a big heart. I mean, I got down there. Well, I got to tell you a little bit before I got down there. So I don't know how many people y'all remember the Len Baez story, but he was a basketball player. And the day he was number one pro pick in the 90s, and the day he got picked, he went out and partied that night. He got high on crack and OD'd. And I call this story my Len Baez story, but I didn't die. So on the way down there, I decided to party, get really messed up. And I thought I was just going to party my way into this new lifestyle. Everything's taken care of, hanging with these big dogs. And I get down there, I'm partying, and you know, he's serious. He's about business. He's got a house, he's got a family, he's building another house for a band member. He's talking about building me a small house out there. I mean, I was just like blown away. And you know, these guys basically snowboard, travel, and play music. You know, that's my style. I would love to do that. So long story short, I just could not lay off the sauce. And I said, I know it sounds weird, but I was on the mountain up there, and I literally asked God to take everything, and I was just, you know, messed up. And within a month, I lost my vehicle, I lost my dog, I got arrested, and they brought me to a town like 90 miles north of where my vehicle was and where my dog was. So they hold me there, I don't know for how many days. I didn't say anything, and, you know, so they let me out. You know, I'm in this hick town in northern California, and I'm from a small town, so at the time I had big, long dreadlocks. So I know, like, a big old hippie guy walking around the road, you know, to, like, some country boys, you're probably going to, there's high chances you might get messed with. And because there's two type of farmers up there, you got the hippies and you got the country boys. So I start trying to hitch my way back to the place, and I got presented by some cops. I tried to come after the cops with, you know, a piece of steel. They arrest me again. You know, it was a bad scene. So long story short, I end up in a mental hospital again. And they let me, after I talked to them a while, come back to Florida. I couldn't believe it. So I came back to Florida, and I thought I had some charges over my head, and my parents wanted me to go to treatment. And when I found out they, there was no charges, I just wanted to go back and party. So I went back to my lifestyle, and a guy ended up... not that I directly knew, he got shot. And I couldn't get that out of my head, you know, that, you know, here I am trying to do all this stuff, make this money, and live this different lifestyle, and, you know, innocent people are getting taken out. And so my mom's like, why don't you go back to college, you know, because I left as a senior, so I go back to college. And my disease progressed really quick. I went back there. I was only drinking a little, smoking a little. And I went to Jazz Fest, and I just couldn't stop. And I went home. My parents didn't want anything to do with me. I was supposed to go to Italy to see my sister dance. And went back, and I was on financial aid. So I was like, screw it. I'll just live on the streets until school starts and I get my check, because I decided to not go to summer school. And I threatened the guy again. I thought he was coming after me. So the cop goes, you know, did you threaten this guy? And I didn't think anything of it, you know. He's like, did you ask him if he wants to die? And this, and I said, yes, sir. I thought I could yes, sir, no, sir. I'm like, you know, when you get pulled over for a ticket, and he's like, you're under arrest. And I was like, I was kind of relieved, but it scared. So I spent about 2 months in jail. And thank God the judge did an arraignment. I got to go to treatment. And that's where everything really turned around. That was in 2001. So I come to treatment. I loved it. It was a blast, you know. Make a PB&J, make spaghetti, you know. Guys don't have to watch you pee. You know, I mean, it was big time. And there's doctors and lawyers there complaining about everything. And I'm like, y'all don't know, man, how good you got it. So, I'd been into this spiritual stuff before. And so I sat through a few of those classes. And after the first week, I wanted to go back to jail. I was like, this is bull. You know, there's just, no. I know where we're going with this God stuff and looking inside and change. Because I tried that a few times. And every time I tried to rearrange myself, change myself, my stuff got bad, really bad. And I believed in a God. And I thought I was just a bad person, and I was going to die a bad person. And once they mentioned the word disease, and I bought into that concept with the first step, I was just like, this is cool. Because I like getting off the hook. Don't get me wrong. I mean, you give me an avenue out, I like it. And I was like, this is great. I'm not a bad person. You mean I got a shot? And that's what they told me. So I got a sponsor, started working the steps. My first sponsor told me the most important word in the whole steps is the first. It's we. We do it together, not alone. Got into step three with him, and then he was busy. Got another sponsor, got up to the, did the fifth step, moved down to South Tampa, got another sponsor, worked all the way through the steps, and that guy knows everything about me up till that point. You know, he may not know a little bit in sobriety because I have a new sponsor, but that guy knows everything, and I felt so relieved. I mean, I got to tell him stuff that I thought I was definitely going to die, like I said, a bad person. And he, you know, it's cool. You know, you always end up with that right sponsor. And he's like, oh, I did that, or this happened to me. And I'm like, wow, that's crazy. And he's telling, you know, he's getting honest with me. And that's just like that lady before me. You know, she got unbelievably honest about some stuff. Gave me a lot of courage to get up here and tell my story. Got a job. Actually, I was unemployable in the beginning. And eventually I got a job after about a year of sobriety and kept working and trying to move up, make more money. And then in my third year of sobriety, I met my soon-to-be wife, my fiance, which was a blessing, still is a blessing. We bought a house, and about 3 months after we bought the house, I randomly call a buddy of mine out in Oregon and to tell him, because another guy's the same birthday as me, and he's like, I know someone who needs a home. So I think, because I'm doing financing at the time, mortgages, I think he's going to tell me about someone in Tallahassee or Gainesville that needs a loan. He's like, Nama. And Nama was my dog who was getting taken care of by another guy when I ended up homeless. And that guy ended up ODing on drugs, and they wanted to do something with the dog because he had the sister too, and they couldn't stay together. They were blue pits, and they'd kind of get into it. And I was working on this land project up in Tallahassee. They lived in Tallahassee, and I was heading up there Thursday. So my best friend up until that time, my dog, I got to go up there and explain to these people, these parents who just lost their son to this addiction, that they're not bad parents, that he was suffering from a disease, and that he was a good person, and, you know, he just, bad stuff happens sometime. And I got my dog back, and that was a really weird thing in sobriety. So we actually put her down a little bit over a year ago, but had a good, you know, 5 years or whatever with her. So a few other good things happened in life, you know, got great relationship with my mom and dad, society, all that good stuff. But I want to talk about a little thing that happened to me in sobriety that's kind of difficult. At 7.5 years sober, after the market crashed and I was working on this project, I had my savings invested in real estate, and stuff was getting upside down, and I was starting to live on savings and, you know, trying to, you know, use credit during different times to work on projects, and, you know, it just got stressful, and I was working for myself, and, you know, on the outside I was looking all good, and this goes back to a young kid, you know, I started putting money as my higher power, and I had no clue, you know, I'd pray in the morning, I'd pray at night, I'd go to meetings, I had sponsees, and I had no clue, I mean, just no clue that I was putting money first, I mean, absolutely no clue. And I had I was just about to get married, and had all this going on, and I was working on these deals, thousands of dollars, and all I wanted to do, I was like $300,000 in the hole, and all I wanted to do was get a couple of these larger deals to close so I could get married and be in the plus. It just was like killing me to be like in the hole and get married when, like, years before that I was doing fine. I mean, it was just devastating, and I wasn't getting honest about it. I was on the outside looking good. So I had what you call a classic manic episode, and I probably didn't sleep for almost a week. And I always told myself, as my go-to solution early on in sobriety is, before I drink or drug or kill myself, I would go into a mental hospital. And I had a lot of friends come over, had Josh, had Neil, had Martin, had a handful of people all come over my house. They heard what was going on, and they were just like, bro, you need to get some help. And my fiance's brother-in-law is a sheriff, and he came over, and he's just like, and he's not a warm and fuzzy guy, and he's like, bro, I love you like a brother, you need help. And I remembered in that moment what I said, so I checked myself into the mental hospital, and it was so embarrassing to be, you know, 7.5 years sober going into a mental hospital. But it was the best thing that happened for me. I got to get some sleep, you know. you know, got to, you know, there's some cool motherfuckers, or cool. There's some cool people in the mental hospital. There's a lot of us in there, believe me. They just ain't ready to come in the rooms. A lot of people. So, you know, friends visited me. They welcomed me. Got back on track. And that dose of humility about finances, you know, I guess that's just something God saw that I needed. And it took that, you know, to almost lose my life, my sanity, people in my life that I love, because I couldn't get honest about money. And so other things can kill you besides alcohol. But, you know, I'm still sober. How long? 10? Well, I got a new sponsor, and he told me not to lie tonight. That's how he told me to tell my story. I guess I'll just tell some stories. You know, I met Josh early on in treatment. You know, it's awesome. He's a miracle that I got to personally watch. I sponsored him for years, and I feel like he's sponsored me more than I've sponsored him sometimes, watching him do things, and just especially lately as everything I went through. You know, he was there when I went into the hospital. Just the faith and the hope that people have in these rooms. Currently, I'm working a lot of step two. I changed jobs recently, got other things going on in my life, and I love step two because I typically believe that my life's unmanageable and I'm powerless over things without God's help. And if I'm not sane, you know, if I'm talking to myself, if I got that monkey on my back, you know, like the girl said before, I'm in the past or I'm in the future. And that's what I consider out of touch with reality, is typically if I'm talking to myself, I'm insane. I mean, don't get me wrong, if you're doing your homework and you're thinking out A or B or C or D to pick and, you know, those type of things, that's probably normal. But my type of thinking isn't normal sometimes when I'm talking to myself, you know. It's like, hurt this person. Quit this job. Run. And those are softly said. I got, you know, if I went in depth how I really felt about those situations, I'd probably maybe have to go back to the hospital tonight. You know, one of the greatest things too that I really love is the helping of others. Currently, I have a friend that he wants to open up some halfway houses. Open up some businesses to support the halfway houses, and he knows I wanted to do something like that. I was trying to work on a project to do something like that for people in poverty, and I really feel fortunate. He asked me to be on the board when he gets it going, and he knows my story. You know, he knows everything that happened to me about being homeless, about being an alcoholic. He knows what happened in sobriety. And he's just like, man, I'd really love to have you as part of this project. And, you know, that's a really cool thing to happen. And the neatest thing about it is, or the toughest thing, is giving the God of my understanding credit for it. Because I'll be honest with you, you know, it took about a half a day to pipe down from that excitement. You know, I was like, oh yeah, I got it. You know, we're going to do great and, you know, be known for setting up massive amounts of this, saving this many people. And, you know, and I'm like, no. That's not what's going on. You know, basically, God's helping people and, you know, working as a channel through us. And, man, if I keep talking, I'm definitely going to lie. So what I'm going to say is I really appreciate this, this talking up here.
Hi, my name's Clark, and I'm an alcoholic. This is Dr. Bob's last message, delivered at the First International Conference of Alcoholics Anonymous at Cleveland, Ohio in 1950. I get a big thrill out of looking over a vast sea of faces like this with the feeling that possibly some small thing I did a number of years ago played an infinitely small part in making this meeting possible. I also get quite a thrill when I think that we all had the same problem. We all did the same things. We all get the same results in proportion to our zeal and enthusiasm and stick-to-itiveness. If you will pardon the injection of a personal note at this time, let me say that I have been in bed for 5 of the last 7 months, and my strength has not returned as I would like. So my remarks of necessity will be very brief. But there are 2 or 3 things that flash into my mind which would be fitting to lay a little emphasis. One is the simplicity of our program. Let's not louse it up with Freudian complexes and things that are interesting to the scientific mind, but have very little to do with our actual AA work. Our 12 steps, when simmered down to the last, resolve themselves into the words, love and service. We understand what love is and we understand what service is. So let's bear those 2 things in mind. Let's also remember to guard the erring member of the tongue. And if we must use it, let us use it with kindness and consideration and tolerance. And one more thing. None of us would be here today if someone hadn't taken the time to explain things to us, to give us a little pat on the back, to take us to a meeting or 2, to have done the numerous little kind and thoughtful acts on our behalf. So let us never get the degree of smug complacency that we are not willing to extend or attempt to that help which has been so beneficial to us, to our less fortunate brothers. Thank you very much.